You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Good to talk with you. I hope that this recording thing is working. That's all I have to say. I hope the recording.
We've had various technical issues, but yeah. I think we're in good shape. We're in a little bit of a time crunch today. We have to keep this very focused. None of your meandering, Matt. You just gotta stick to business.
Well, it's actually gonna be a lot of meandering, assuming people can hear me. I wanted to talk a little bit about this Trump University thing. I'm writing something about this at the Daily Caller now, and I think that the allegations about upselling were basically Trump people who worked for Trump who were allegedly handpicked but really not would get. People who came to these seminars who wanted to learn about real estate to put things on credit card, to go into debt, and they would try to get them to buy like the gold or premium package even if they didn't need it. That's the allegation, and it really reminded me of like, I'll tell you a couple of experiences I had. I don't know if you had anything like this. So one time I got dragged along with my dad to this they wanted us to buy into a timeshare, and they promised like all you had to do was listen to this spiel and you would either come away with a truck or a boat. And there was actually talk about us renting like a trailer to haul our boat back. At the end of it, they hand us a cardboard box with a inflatable boat in it. Oh, my dad also sold Amway for a while, and I don't think he ever actually sold any Amway, but I went to some of those meetings, and we definitely had a lot of Glister toothpaste around the house, and as I write in my piece, years later, I would be approached by a middle-aged couple at a Ruby Tuesdays who saw me wearing a campaign t-shirt, and they promised me that all I had to do was just listen to them and they'd buy me dinner, and I was fully expecting to eat all their food and turn down a devil's threesome at the end of this. a sort of an indecent proposition. It was indecent. They wanted me to sell Amway. So this is all like a long way of saying that I I think that this is the kind of issue where look, nothing so far has stuck to Trump. But if Hillary, and it's a big if, but if they can cast him as somebody who's exploiting people, not a man of the people, but an exploiter of the people, that would be a very damning thing to stick to him. I have to say, this bothers me more, maybe just my personal experience, but if someone is like sort of lazy, I don't think you should exploit anybody, but the sort of the thing that really bothers me about this sort of exploitation is that it targets people who are naive, but ambitious is the wrong word. I mean, these are people who are trying to make a better life, and they may not have the background or the resources to see through con artists. And look, I don't want to lump in Amway with that. I mean, I think Amway's probably a legitimate company, but in any event, this thing sort of resonates with me, and I wonder if it's going to stick or not.
Well, isn't there a challenge in telling somebody you're being scammed right now?
Yeah.
Isn't there sort of an inherently condescending element that you're too stupid to understand that Trump's running a con
on
you?
It's like waking up a sleepwalker. Like nothing right. Good can come from that,
And I mean, I feel you've written about scam conservative outfits.
Yeah, scam packs.
So there's definitely a scam pack world, and I don't feel I see that on the left, really. I do think that if you listen to talk radio, whether it is the left or the right, there are lots of scam type advertising that goes on, which makes you think, you know, who's listening to these shows. Why would they run these ads? Are they wearing, you know, hooking some people along the way? Otherwise, they'd fish in some other pool. So there's definitely some constituency of people who get amped up on politics who are susceptible to scams. So is there a risk here for Hillary to try to drive a wedge between the con artist and the conned?
Yeah, I think this is I don't know that it's risky, but I do know that it's you keep hearing that the Clintons have settled on a strategy. I think they're still testing this. I mean, I think that the theory is the Democrats have basically for decades been able to cast Republicans as sort of rich and not caring about the poor. And Trump, ironically, because he's a billionaire, ironically defies that stereotype. And I think that the Clintons realize if we can sort of undermine his image as an everyman and instead cast him as an exploiter of everyman or of sort of average people, then that's a death knell for him. So I think that they have to try to do this. And I think there's plenty of evidence that supports that Trump was bilking people. Now, the funny thing or the interesting thing about it is normally when Trump is accused of something, he basically says, who cares? Hey, I'm a businessman. This is what I did. He can't do that here. So what he's doing instead is something different. He's muddying the water. He's saying this is a politically motivated attack. The judge is out to get me. Then he'll present, and I'm sure there are people who have attended Trump University who had a good experience and went on to make money in the real estate business. He'll present them. So he's going to muddy the waters. But I think the fact that he can't just sort of cavalierly dismiss this and laugh it off does suggest that there's a potential vulnerability there.
How damning, so take a step away from the Trump University stuff, or should I say step away from the fraudulent basis of Trump University, there are these quotes that he made in a Trump University presentation talking about his real estate strategies in 2006 and how he was looking forward to a housing bubble and can buy up all the distressed properties and make a killing. I think he says, like, I'm sort of looking forward to it. I'm excited about it. There's certain language that suggested he would welcome this opportunity. And then the response is, well, I'm a businessman. What do you expect? Yeah. That's what business people do. It strikes me as there's a zero-sum quality to almost everything about Trump. When you're talking about foreign policy, you know, how dare South Korea get our defense help without paying their fair share? All these free riders are there. They're not paying for their defense. I'm going to make them pay as if it's going to be this massive windfall that comes in. When he's talking about immigration, he talks about gender. He's saying, you know, the women, they get it better than us. It's always someone's taking something from you and you got to take your share back. And so when it comes to the real estate stuff, it's, well, if someone suffers from the bust, I'm going to take from that person's suffering and profit myself.
Right.
Is that a kind of outlook on life and society that generally appeals to the Republican base, and therefore when Trump says it about his business practices, people say, well, of course you do that. That is what a business person does. That's what capitalism is. I'm not gonna fault you for that. Or is there a way to say, look, that might be fine for a business person, but for a public official, I don't want zero-sum politics. If you're just taking from someone else to benefit some other group, That's not lifting all boats. That's not win-win. I want win-win politics, not win-lose politics.
Right.
Is there an opening there, or is there or just enough people in that sort of zero-sum mind frame that wouldn't work?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've spoken to a lot of small business owners like Trump and support Trump, and I, you know, talked to one of them when I was out in Arizona promoting my book, and he said, like, life is, you know, he's a small business guy. He's like, hey, it is a zero sum game. I mean, if I own a company in town and someone opens a competing company, that they will take my business, and this is the real world. Now, this flies in the face of sort of, you know, Paul Ryan, Marco Rubio conservative philosophy, Jack Kemp philosophy, which basically argues that we can grow the pie, that the Malthusian theory of scarcity is wrong, and that actually more people equals more ideas and innovation This is a more negative viewpoint that Trump believes in, but I think it's a popular one because I think it's simple and it's easily comprehensible, and it, at least on the surface, it appears to be common sense that if someone has something, then I can't have it. I think it works. In terms of being politically damaging, I think this Trump University thing does have the potential to be more damaging than the arguments, though, about the housing bubble. Because in the case of the housing bubble, I think you could argue, you know, basically he was a businessman and he can prosper during down times. And he's going to put that to work for us. He's going to put his ability to make money, even in a down housing market, to work for us. It's harder to argue because he allegedly was able to upcharge and bilk naive people out of money, that he will somehow put that to work for us, that skill to work for us. So I think that the Trump, you know, clearly I think that at least the Clinton people believe that the Trump University thing has potential, that some of the other things that would have been scandals for anybody else, but have been, you know, sort of Teflon with Trump, this one seems to be a bit more promising for them. Again, though, who knows if it will actually resonate? Nothing else really has.
Yeah, and I agree that they're probably in an experimental phase between now and the convention to test run certain ideas. But I do, you get the sense that they drove the Trump youth harder than anything else so far. They must feel like there's juice there.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of that Republicans, even though they touched on it, that they never really went there. And I think also there's the timeliness, the quality of it. I mean, there's, you know, court hearings, I guess, and things being...
Well, the doc dump came out this week.
Documents coming out. So there's a lot of, you know, I think the fact that Republicans never really litigated this issue fully, the fact that there's a timely news hook, all those things I think are conspiring to make this an issue they're trying to drive this week.
Now, there's a lot of third-party activity going on right now. Gary Johnson just barely won the Libertarian nomination at their convention over the weekend. Bill Weld barely won the VP nomination. They're getting a lot of press this week. They've done a number of TV interviews. They sat for a New York Times interview. They're doing joint interviews. You know, their resumes are more traditional presidential resumes than Donald Trump's resume is, so it's hard to dismiss them.
Yeah.
You got two governors on a Libertarian ticket. That's pretty unusual. And there are polls consistently showing when it's Johnson by himself as the only third-party choice, he's getting about 10%. When he's in there with Jill Stein, his number is lower, but still not zero. And you need 15 to get into the debate, so it's still got some work to do, but it's not totally implausible. And now you have this leak that Bill Kristol's trying to recruit a National Review staff writer, David French. I don't see why he didn't turn to a Weekly Standard staff writer from his own magazine. That's kind of insulting to his own staff, in my opinion.
Why not Bill? Why not Bill Kristol if he really believes in this? I mean,
well, Bill Kristol actually served in government. Bill Kristol got a better resume than David French does.
And I think so, he's got the name. You know, look, the guy that he's pushing, David French, is a constitutional lawyer. He's a decorated military veteran. He's an author and a best-selling author, I believe, and about ISIS. So he knows foreign policy, and he's a really good writer at National Review. But as I said in roll call, as of today, I'm more famous than he is, and that's a problem. Like, you know, Bill, this is the kind of thing, you know, like, you know, I think it would have been fascinating if somebody like Bill Kristol had actually run. He's got a lot of name ID. He's sort of a happy warrior, and he obviously feels like this is a mission that, I mean, I think part of it is that he's trolling us and that he's getting publicity out of this, but I think part of it is, sincerely, Kristol thinks that we need an alternative, and why not Bill Kristol? I don't know.
That's odd to me, but it seems like even if David French is not a household name today, in theory, what's missing in the race right now is a candidate who is a foreign policy neoconservative and a domestic social conservative. I mean, social conservatives are leery of Trump. Don't think he's been with them on abortion issues. He's been trying to be both sides of the fence on the transgender rights issues, and clearly doesn't take a neoconservative line foreign policy wise. And Gary Johnson is also a social liberal and more of a foreign policy isolationist. So they're not being served by anybody in this race. Yeah. So as long as they had somebody that would fit their worldview.
And French is also a sort of social conservative, and that's
right.
Missing.
Right.
I mean, there's nobody for social conservatives. I would vote for, if David French is on my ballot, I'll vote for him. But I think that essentially his constituency is about as large as the Weekly Standard break room. I mean, that's about.
Oh, I doubt he would get. I doubt he'd crack 5%. But I mean, if Trump is going to win, and I'm not saying he's in the driver's seat right now, it wouldn't be a blowout. It would be close.
Yeah.
And any little thing that pulls away from you doesn't help. So he would still be able a way to say to Republicans, you can't have a majority coalition without the neocons and the social cons.
I know, but I think that's
proof of that.
That is so fraught with danger. I mean, look, the goal of a third party candidate should be to keep anybody from getting to 270 electoral votes so that it throws it to the House. But probably, maybe more likely would be that David French just, you know, keeps Donald Trump from getting if he just takes a few percent in a battleground state, then Hillary Clinton could end up winning. And even if you're a conservative who believes that Hillary Clinton would be better than Trump, there is a huge price to be paid if the perception is that Trump would have won had it not been for this meddling. And that would only prolong, I think, the identity crisis on the right and only sort of increase bitterness and division on the right. I mean, if Trump is to lose, I think you want him to lose without any footnotes, without any finger pointing.
So no one else gets the blame.
Exactly.
But there's still a massive challenge, assuming he did jump. I mean, getting on the ballots. I mean, he'd be totally independent, I assume. There's no party infrastructure he can work with. There's no party he can jump onto right now. Some filing deadlines have already passed. You need a lot of money to get the staff to collect the signatures. I mean, we're in June already, for Pete's sake.
And some states have already passed the deadline for Texas and, I think, Indiana, a couple other states. Look, I mean, this is really – the fact that you're ending up with David French, who I think is an honorable and accomplished guy but not well-known. I mean, the fact that you've ended up with him and that you've ended up with him at this – and by the way, we don't even know if he's going to run. But the fact that this is where we are at this point in the election – is indicative of the larger problem about how we were never able to muster any sort of credible anti-Trump movement. I mean, it was true in the primaries, and it remains true to this day. And, you know, in terms of the libertarians, you know, let's say Gary Johnson gets to 15%. Is there any reason to believe he would be a good debater? Like, I'm not sure getting in the debates helps Gary Johnson, even against people like as unlikable as Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Gary Johnson just seems like a weird sort of guy. I don't know that he would be. It's not like if he can just get in the debates, he's going to, you know, do a great job. So this, you know, it's just a weird, weird election.
Well, we only got about 5 minutes left, but I do want to talk to my latest piece in Politico, which was titled "Why the Left Hates Hillary." Yeah. So after writing "Bernie loses his halo" and "Is Sanders becoming Nader?" and "All the Sanders voters mad at me that I'm fostering awful narratives," at least I got some Hillary people mad at me, that based on the headline, "What do you mean the left hates Hillary? She's winning the race, and I'm left, and I love Hillary, so screw you." So I got everybody mad at me now. So I've had that accomplishment, but I still have Sanders people mad at me because the nut of the piece is that we all know there's a generational divide in the Democratic Party over Hillary, and that older voters are voting for about more than 2-1, and younger voters voting against her about 2-1. So why is it? Do they have this totally different impression of her outlook and her character? What I came back to is, you know, the older voters were around in the 90s. The younger voters were not. The narrative that the younger voters have about the 90s is wildly different than the older voters. But beyond that, when Hillary started the race, and I think recognizing that she had to reintroduce herself to a lot of voters out there, and she sold herself as sort of a progressive at her core, she talked about her life in the 70s, you know, being a civil rights activist, Children's Defense Fund, infiltrating segregated schools to rat out racism in schools. Bill Clinton went on the stump talking about her policy initiatives in the 80s in Arkansas. They don't talk about the 90s very much. I mean, she talks about the 90s in terms of Bill Clinton had a great economic record in the 90s. She doesn't talk about her 90s record. I mean, it's not zero. There's the China speech, for example, she gets into. But the main event of her time in the 90s was healthcare, which was terrible. But by not talking about it, she doesn't mention that her fight for healthcare was a Bernie-style fight where she lashed out at the corporate interests and she refused to meet with them. She stumped around the country to rally the public to defeat them, not to compromise with them. And didn't work. So not only does the Bernie side not really know the details of how she approached it, there's also this sort of lack. There's a missing chapter of the narrative how she got from her younger days to her older days, and it's too pat to say she was a raging liberal and now she's a chastened moderate, because there are moderate elements in her younger days too. But it was a shattering experience for her.
It's ironic that life experience and wisdom sometimes end up as a negative, or baggage, you know. And in this case, she is a product of her experiences and things she's learned along the way, and that might be her greatest detriment.
I mean, and so there's a story to tell there about, you know, what she went through and why and how she changed her outlook after that. And I don't think that if she told the story that all the Bernie supporters would magically love her and abandon Bernie. I don't think it's remotely that simple. But there's a difference between believing she is a neoconservative tool of Wall Street, a corporatist at her core, versus somebody who generally agrees in the same goals as us, but we disagree on the tactical way to approach it.
Right.
If it's the latter, it's a lot easier to settle on Hillary after the primary, whereas you got a bunch of folks now that are saying she is just as bad, if not worse, than Trump, and there's no way I can vote for her. But she probably can't go tell that story now. I mean, it's not the greatest story in the world. It's not an inspirational story. So it's tricky for her, but I do think that's a missing piece of the puzzle.
Well, speaking of the 90s, Bill, let me segue into a plug. I just did a podcast with Alex Pappas and Jim Elfringham about the 90s, about 90s nostalgia, whether it's, you know, I mean, we're talking about Hillary Clinton and Vince Foster, and we're talking about O.J. Simpson. I just saw something about how if it wasn't for the TV show Friends going away, Donald Trump's apprentice wouldn't have got greenlit. I mean, it's just so weird how much the 90s are back again. So we did a whole show on that. And I also did a podcast where I interviewed Yuval Levin, the author of The Fractured Republic, which is a fascinating read. And you can get that at Matt Lewis and the News, my podcast on iTunes. I also want to plug, I'm interviewing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on June 7th at the American Enterprise Institute. He has a new book out as well. So if you're in town, please come by and hear me interview the Senate Majority Leader. And also, Bill, what's the political piece? What's the title?
So Why the Left Hates Hillary.
Yeah, I know you're killing it. You're tearing it up at Politico and Real Clear Politics.
Thank you. So, thank you, sir. I did a Nader piece for Real Clear Politics, but we hashed that out last week anyway. I do have to run.
Yeah, good show.
So we'll talk after the June 7th primaries.
All right, see you guys.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.